Which were you looking for?
Oh.
A cushion?
Oh. That's really short-term loss of memory.
No, just very, very short-term. Unimportant things.
No, everything is important when it comes to memory.
Yeah, oh yes, yeah. I'm soon going to memorize a deck of cards. just for my own sake.
Three kinds of karma by T.M.P. Mahadevan. Extracts from an unpublished commentary on Shankara's Manisapanchakam.
What is Manisapanchakam?
Well, Panchakam is five, and Manisa. On what? Something in mind or Manisa?
Verses or?
When one gains release through knowledge, one's body need not fall. In fact, the continuance of the body is no way incompatible with the status of release.
With the status of what?
Release.
Oh, release.
What happens when release is gained is a change in perspective. Before release, one took the world of which the body is a part to be real. After gaining self-knowledge, one realizes that the world is an illusory appearance. If the body were real, release could come only after the destruction of the body. But since the body is not real, its continued appearance or disappearance is of no consequence. Karma, which is responsible for the repeated embodiment of the soul, is threefold. Sanchitta, the fund of accumulated deeds of the past, which will bring about future births. Agami, the deeds that one does in the present life and will do in the future lives. These will be added to the sanchitta. And parabdha, that portion of the past deeds which had given rise to the present birth. For example, the karma that had begun to fructify in the form of the present embodiment. Of these three varieties of karma, sanchitta and agami do not belong to the man of realization because they get burnt up in the fire of knowledge and they do not any longer affect him by producing merit, punya, or demerit, papa, both of which are evil insofar as they perpetuate transmigration. If it be asked, how could the man of realization be absolved from the evil results of sanchitta and agami? We reply, even because he does no longer identify himself with the illusory projections of nescience, beginning with egoity, ahankara, and ending with the physical body, his realization is of the form of the truth. Quote, I did nothing in the past, I do nothing in the present, I shall do nothing in the future, and all the three times I am free from the sense of being an agent of actions. I am Brahman. Unquote. What others may continue to observe as his actions are not his actions. They do not attach themselves to him, even as water does not stick to the lotus leaf. Thus, for the man of knowledge, or self-knowledge, there are no deeds, whether good or bad, nor the consequences thereof. As we have already shown, even meritorious deeds are of the nature of evil, since they too cause embodiment. There now remains the question about parabdha karma. Why should this too not be destroyed for the man of self-knowledge? The one who asks this question is the one who bears a body and is yet unreleased. Such a one sees the Jivan Mukta also to continue living in a body. The answer has to be framed in language that he can understand. The continuance of the Jiva Mukta's body for a while longer has to be accounted for. The present body is a result of Prarabdha. It is only when the fruit of Prarabdha has been exhausted that the body will fall. But the continuance of the body does not in any way affect the Mukta state of wisdom, for he knows that the body is not real, that it is but an illusory appearance. But then, the continuance of the effect after the cause has ceased to be may be objected to. When nescience, the cause of bondage and embodiment, has been destroyed, how could the body stay on? In answering this objection, several illustrations are given. The potter may remove the rod from the wheel on which he shapes the pot, but the wheel continues to rotate till the momentum is spent. Similarly, even though the cause of embodiment, nescience, has been destroyed through knowledge, its effect, the body, may persist till the prarabdha gets exhausted through enjoyment. In a dream, a person sees a ferocious tiger. He is seized with fright and wakes up. Now the cause of fear has been removed, yet the person's body continues to tremble for a time. This is another example. Let us imagine an archer practicing archery. He has a number of arrows in his quiver. One of the arrows he has taken out of the quiver and shot from his bow at a target. Another he has taken in hand and placed it on the string ready to be shot. Now, let us suppose that at this stage the archer resolves not to continue the practicing of archery. He may then throw away the quiver full of arrows. He may also cast away the arrow that he has in his hand. But he cannot recall the arrow he has already released from his bow. That must do its work. And only then will it stop. This illustration may help us in understanding why, while Sanchitta and Agami do not exist for the Jiva Mukta, Prarabdha must work itself out and is therefore inescapable. To the question how to destroy Prarabdha, the answer is by enjoying the merit and demerit occasioned by it. This is what is meant when it is stated that the Jiva Mukta offers up his body to Prarabdha. But all this explanation, it should be remembered, is from the standpoint of the unreleased. For the Jiva Mukta, there is no body at all. And so, there is no need either for explaining the continuance of the body. Continued presence from Muruganar's Ramana Anubhuti, translated by Professor K. Swaminathan. Having cured me of my separateness, must you, as if to test me, Spirit Supreme, withdraw your form from sight? Where have you gone, my God, forsaken me? Where have you hidden yourself? Deep from within me comes the answer clear. Here, in the heart, your very self am I. Know well this truth, the oneness of the self, destroying thus in every limb the false deluding eye. He shines instead in wondrous splendor now as I, the only self. So we're going karma, dharma, and purushottama. Karma and grace, Swami Brahma, Yogeshwar. And God and destiny, Devraj Madhulya. Dayaraj Madhavi is one of the senior most devotees. He wrote an article for us on the Maharshi and the Path of Devotion in our issue of October 1964. It was largely owing to failing eyesight that he left the ashram late in 1965. In the issue of January 1966, we put a farewell note in the ashram bulletin. Now Dayaraj has already had an operation for cataract on one eye and is able to write again. And we are very glad to welcome this new article from him. So the only problem was cataract, which is a simple thing these days. Right? So here's a quote, sounds like a poem. The moving figure writes, and having writ, moves on, nor all your piety nor wit shall lure it back to conceal half a line, nor all your tears wash out a word of it.
What is that?
Omar Khayyam.
You know that by heart?
Hmm? Omar Khayyam.
Omar Khayyam.
Oh, Omar.
Can we hear it again, please? If you I want to appreciate it properly.
Okay, Mark, I'll repeat it.
The moving finger writes, and having writ moves on, nor all your piety, nor all your wit shall lure it back to cancel half a line, nor all your tears wash out a word of it.
Wow.
And so what does that mean now?
I'm going to find out. I'm going to read the article.
Oh, the whole article based on that? No.
In my opinion, Omar was not a scoffer when he wrote this, but an earnest seeker brought up against the impenetrable wall of predestination. Mm-hmm. The majority of Hindus also believe that destiny cannot be overcome. They speak of God having written their fate and life on their foreheads, so that all events, pleasant and painful, will come to them as ordained. Those who have studied the question of karma declare, however, that destiny is not anything imposed on them by an arbitrary God, but is a result of the law of cause and effect. Each man having to go through such experiences as his past actions have provoked. Each action of a man is followed by its consequences, whether pleasurable or painful, and no man can escape them. If it is not possible to exhaust all the consequences of one's actions in one lifetime, one may have to pass through successive lives to exhaust one's karma. This doctrine has been welcomed by serious thinkers because it gives some rational explanation to the great differences between man and man that we find in the world. How could one explain otherwise the vast differences in a world created and governed by a just, impartial, and loving God? The doctrine of karma is so basic to Hinduism that we cannot conceive of Hinduism without it. Karma is classified into three categories, prarabdha, agami, and sanchitta. When a man is born, the amount of the accumulated, he's going over all the same things. But he lived with Bhagavan for many years. That's,
oh, yeah.
That's right.
I'm glad to hear that that's why he left, because I couldn't figure it out.
No, that's not right. This is 1965.
Did he come back again?
He came back again, and he left in 1965. We're talking about 1945 he left.
Oh, okay.
The ashram.
Just for cataract operation?
Yeah. Well, he was probably living in the ashram just a few years, but this is much after Bhagavan's Mahasamadhi.
Oh, right, okay.
Nowhere, now here, by G.V. Subramaya. Sri Bhagavan used to say that the Sanskrit term Mahashunya, which is used as a synonym for Brahman, and means literally the great non-being, can also be resolved into Maha Ashunya, meaning the great being. So in the right perspective, the great negative becomes the great positive. This is precisely parallel by the English nowhere, one word, which corresponds to Mahashunya. It also can be split up into now here, which means the immediate present. So Brahman is not only the transcendental absolute, but also the immediate present. Boons yearned for and earned by sin. There is a saying, God gives every bird its food, but does not necessarily throw it into the nest. This is crude.
I'm sorry, gives every what its
food? Every bird its food, but doesn't necessarily throw it into the nest.
Bird its food.
It doesn't necessarily throw the food into the nest.
The food.
It has to go looking for it.
Throw the bird into the nest.
That's what it said to throw the bird into the nest.
Well, it has to go looking for the food. This is not long. This is crudely the truth of material existence. God is grace and so provides food. But the bird should have wings to come down and pick up the worm that lies right under its nest. Or, if still wingless, at least should have compassionate parents. Anyway, one should make the effort to deserve grace. Grace, destiny, and effort are interdependent. And the relationship can be understood to some extent from the following story. Once there was a discussion between Shiva and Parvati. The goddess wanted proof of the interlinking of effort and destiny and how they functioned under the grace of God. Shiva, in reply, took Parvati to the earth and showed her a temple, where two aspirants were worshipping him devoutly. Both were going round and round the shrine inside the temple, non-stop, all day and night. Must be Ramanashram, right? Because they keep going around the Samadhi and Bhagavan. There was this guy from, he came here once, he said, I visited the ashram in India, and I saw people were walking around and around the samadhi. You know, they have you can walk around the samadhi. There are all people walking around. So I started walking around that, I started walking around with them. And I found it very elevating. You know, my mind became very calm and I kept walking with them. He said, what is that place anyhow? He had no idea it was Bhagavan Samadhi. He had no idea that Ramana Maharshi was buried there.
That is interesting. I went to where,
I didn't know.
You didn't know, right? Nobody knows these things. But he just did what everybody's doing, walking around and around.
And got the benefit. Like Arunachala.
Yeah. All day and night walking around. But with this difference, that the first was doing the production in a clockwise way, and the second, in an anti-clockwise. People had tried to persuade the second to give up going around anti-clockwise and go only in the right way, threatening him with some great calamity that would befall him. He never heeded and continued for years doing it the wrong way. People praised the first for his sincerity, for doing it in the right way, and said he would be rewarded amply by the Lord. When Shiva and Parvati came, Shiva, through his grace, granted them boons. Parvati was shocked. For the second man, on his circumambulation, still going anti-clockwise, tripped over some object and fell, and lo, he found a bag full of gold coins. He shouted to the other, saying that for his apparent wrongdoing, he was rewarded with gold. The first man, almost at the same time, on completion of the pradakshina, met with an accident from the fall of a stone from the roof and lost his toes. People were taken aback to see this apparent injustice. Parvati questioned her Lord as to how he could grant such unjustified boons. Then Shiva explained to Parvati, the first man was a chandala and had committed lots of sins in his previous births, and today he should have lost his life by the fall of the entire temple roof. That was his destiny. Not only was his life saved by his right efforts in this life, but all his past bad karmas have also been washed away. The second man, due to purva punya karma, was due to inherit enormous wealth, which is still hidden exactly under where he got the small bag of gold. But because of his wrongdoing in this life, he not only lost his vast wealth, but also all the past inherited good karmas. Thus, though the grace is always there unchanged, the results are dependent on destiny molded by effort. Bhagavan's Samadhi, choice of a site. The following is an instructive illustration of free will in practice. When it became apparent that Ramana Maharshi would soon leave the body, the Sarvadhikari, or director of the ashram, decided that the body should be buried on the north veranda of the newly constructed meditation hall. You know, his idea was, you know where Bhagavan's statue is there in the new hall? And you know, in front of that statue, there's a lotus on the floor there. Did you notice? There's a lotus carved into the floor, big, maybe about, you know, 5 feet diameter. So if you stand there and you look east, you see the mother's samadhi. So if you would turn right towards the statue, he was going to put a door in there, and then you would see Bhagavan's samadhi. You know what I mean? So you just, if you turn north, you see the samadhi, and you turn east, you see the mother. That was his Sarvadhikari plan.
Yeah.
So the veranda means outside that window behind the statue.
Okay.
And that window would have become a door.
So whose idea was that?
The Sarvadhikaris, Bhagavan's brothers. So, the body should be on the north veranda of the newly constructed meditation hall. It should be added an explanation that it is usual for the body of a realized man to be buried since, having already passed through the fire, he does not need to do so a second time. Even if they burn the body of a jnani, they give great warnings in that scripture that Bhagavan used for preparing a samadhi site. You know, he did for Shishadri Swami, for Mustan Swami. Mm-hmm. You know, how you prepare a site for a jnani.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's great warnings in there. If you burn the body, so much mishap's going to happen to the whole society there, in that area.
Oh, okay.
You know?
They burned around Krishna's body.
But that's North India.
Oh, okay. Different country. That's a different...
So, on the night following the body's death, a number of devotees met together and discussed whether this or some other site should be used. Finally, after considerable discussion, the decision was changed, and a spot just south of the old meditation hall was chosen for the grave and shrine. Those who took part in the discussion put their views freely and freely strove to convert the others to them. K.K. Nambiar had the dream where it should be. Bhagavan showed him. I think they're going to explain that. However, one devotee, K.K. Nambiar, writing years later in the vision, July 1964, on the subject of the death of Swami Ramdas, recalled that in the case of Ramana Maharshi, he had a previous intimation of where the shrine would be before ever the discussion took place. This is what he wrote. I had a dream about Ramana Maharshi attaining Mahasamadhi a few days before the actual event. In the dream, Maharshi himself took me with him and pointed out the spot where he was to be buried. I mentioned the dream to the Sarvaikari, as well as to a few other important devotees. But the place of internment, as seen in the dream, was not acceptable to the Sarvadikari at that time, and he therefore paid no heed to it. But at midnight on the 14th April 1950, the devotees who had gathered at the ashram after Bhagavan Samadhi disagreed with the idea of the Sarvadikari and literally forced him to accept the place where Bhagavan Samadhi is now located. This was exactly the place shown to me in the dream. I had promptly sketched this in my diary book along with the details of the dream. You know, Bhagavan took a stick and drew it in the ground there, you know, drew a line, this is the spot.
He did?
In the dream.
Oh, in the dream.
Yeah. And this guy was the chief engineer of the state of Madras.
Mm.
Yeah. See, the Christian doctrine of grace and free will.
That was not where the Sarvadikari had in mind.
No. That's a big difference.
All those dramas.
Tests.
The cosmic dance, Arthur Osborne. Things flow as they will flow. Yourself, the screen on which is cast, the shadow land. Yourself, the void wherein flows past the rhythmic band. In consciousness all is, all things join hand, in cosmic dance, all circumstance, past and to come, weaving an endless strand, is now, things flow as they will flow. Then there's an article. The will to perversity. The Maharshi's health, a note from Major Chadwick. The Maharshi was never robust, at least not after about 30 years of age. This was no doubt due to the strain he inflicted on his body in his early years at Tiruvannamalai. For years he suffered from asthma. And a photograph taken of him at Skanda Ashram shows him a little more than a skeleton. But he used to, during that picture, he was only eating one meal a day for a year.
And
that's when
the
picture was taken.
Yeah, he was only eating one meal a day.
Suddenly, after 15 years, it left him, the asthma, for no apparent reason, he told me. But he was always liable to catch cold and had frequent digestive trouble. After that, he became a chronic sufferer from rheumatism. His whole body was full of it. As years passed, he had more and more difficulty in walking. Various oils were tried, and he was massaged morning and evening. In 1947, he was given a medicine which had little effect except to bring on a violent attack of hiccups, which lasted for several days in spite of anything the doctors could do. At last, it subsided of its own accord.
I have a question about that. I understand the enlightened yogis sometimes take on big karma, even from the world.
Like Jesus Christ.
With Jesus, yeah. Well, take on the karma and the like in Ramana Maharshi suffered, it could be that a lot of the
physical illnesses.
Yeah.
Is there anything?
Well, there is. Like, they have certain mentions of this. Just recently I read that there was someone who came to the ashram and he was suffering from severe back problem. In fact, he fell across the street from the ashram and he couldn't walk even for days. And it was getting very severe and he was in a lot of suffering. And during the night, even at night, they sent this Amani Amo. She was a woman who was living there to go tell Bhagavan because he couldn't take it anymore. And then this Amani Amo, she said, I can't go at night because no women are allowed. He said, no, just go. So she went at 1 a.m. to the old hall. She looked in the window and the attendants were rubbing ointment on Bhagavan's back.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
She could see it in the light. They had a dim light and they were putting it. And then she didn't even go and tell him. She ran back. And when he got back, he found that he could even stand. He hadn't stood for 2 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. So that.
Yeah, they're written articles about Shiva Bala Yogi, who took on the karma, even once where he was visiting the Middle East, took on the karma of an atom bomb. He said, so to speak, to keep that a lot of.
Yeah, so there's little incidents like that with Bhagavan also.
Yeah.
People suffering and going to see Bhagavan having the same suffering,
yes.
And then that suffering is relieved from them. Effort, grace, and destiny. It is said in scriptures and by gurus that an aspirant must make effort on the path, but that grace also is necessary and that in the end realization is bestowed by grace, not achieved by effort. It is said in the Upanishad that the Atman chooses whom it will. This is a hard saying. Those in whom the spiritual urge is powerful do not worry their heads over it, but strive because they must, because they are drawn to without any thought of reward. Those, however, in whom the mind is too active and the spirit too weak are apt to be puzzled and ask why they should make any effort if the final achievement is not to be won by effort but bestowed by grace. They also ask why the Atma should choose one rather than another. For such people, I will try to clarify the same. Who is the you that has to make effort? And who is the God or Atma that chooses and that bestows grace on one rather than another? The essence of man is pure spirit or, which comes to the same, pure being or pure universal consciousness. This spirit prowls in the lion, spreads in the tree, endures in the stone, and man alone, it not only lives, but knows that it lives. The difference between man and other animals is not that man is greater, has greater ability, in many ways he has less, but that he knows that he is man. He is self-consciously man. This is through the human mind which, looking outward, knows and dominates the world. Looking inward, knows and reflects being as the essence and source of the world. However, the ability to do this implies also the ability to not do it, to regard oneself as a complete autonomous individual and forget the inner reality. The various religions express the simple truth through myth, allegory, and doctrine, and are apt to be puzzling. In the Quran, it is said that Allah offered the trust to the heavens and earth and the mountains, but all declined it. Only man accepted and was untrue to it. Religions assert that God gave man free will, which implies the freedom to rebel. In Christianity, it is said that man is fallen on account of original sin. The book of Genesis gives the story of how man fell into the domain of opposites, the differentiation of good and evil. All these are allegories of the simple truth stated above. The mind creates an ego and seemingly complete, autonomous individual self, which although illusory, seems to be the reality of one. This is the state known in Hinduism as ajnana, or ignorance, in Christianity as original sin. In Islam, it is more violent form of kufr, or denial, in its milder form, recognizing the spirit as real, but believing the ego also to be real as shirk, or association of the other with God. You know, he became a Muslim for some time, Arthur Osborne. Mm-hmm. Like the Sufi, he took initiation and everything.
To Sufism?
I think it was some Sufi master. Mm-hmm. This is the obstruction to self-realization. Therefore, it has to be removed. That is why the masters say that self-realization is not something new to be achieved, but an eternally existent state to be discovered or revealed. Therefore, they compare it to an overcast sky. The clear sky does not have to be created, only the clouds covering it to be blown away, or to a pond overgrown with water lilies. The water is there all the time and only has to be revealed by clearing away the plants that have overgrown it. To do this constitutes the effort of which the teachers and scriptures speak. The mind has created the obstruction. The mind has to remove it. But merely to recognize this, to recognize that is to say that the ego is, according to the Advaitin, an illusory self, or, according to the dualists, a creation of the spirit, to which it should be submitted and totally passive, is far from constituting the full effort required. Indeed, it increases the obligation for total effort, and therefore, so to speak, the guilt and not making effort. The effort involves the will and emotions as well as the understanding, and therefore has to be persistent, determined, and skillful. The ego has put out tentacles which cling to the world, and either these have to be lopped off or the ego itself killed. It craves the admiration or submission of other egos, and therefore humility is enjoined. It craves enjoyment of creation in its own right instead of being a mere channel through which the spirit perceives and enjoys, and therefore celibacy and asceticism are sometimes prescribed, and self-indulgence is always in all religions forbidden. The attempt to lop off the tentacles of the ego has been compared in mythology to a battle with a many-headed giant who grew two new heads for each one lopped off. The only way of disposing of him was to strike at the heart and kill the entire being, not deal with the heads individually. The campaign must be skillful and intelligently planned as well as ruthless. What wonder is different masters, what wonder if different masters in different religions have prescribed different ways of conducting it? The goal in all cases is the same, the taming or destruction of the ego, or the discovery that it never really existed. Methods such as I have been alluding to consist largely in curtailing the ego's outer manifestation so as to induce the mind to turn inwards to the self or spirit behind it. It is also possible to proceed in the opposite direction by turning inward to the spirit, and thence deriving strength to renounce the outer manifestations. This is the path of love and devotion, worshiping God, submitting to Him, calling upon His name, striving to serve and remember Him with one's whole life. Either path can be followed or both together. The third path is that of questioning the very existence of the ego by self-inquiry. All this is effort. Then what about grace? Grace is the natural flow of the Spirit into and through the mind and faculties. There is nothing capricious or erratic about it. Bhagavan said, grace is always there. It is only you who have to make yourself receptive to it. It is likened traditionally to the sunlight falling on a flower garden. If one bud opens and not another, it is not due to any partiality on the side of the sun, but only to the maturity or immaturity of the buds. Or if the sunlight penetrates one room but not another, it is simply because the doors and windows are open in one and in the other shut. Why then is it said that the Atman chooses whom it will, and that the final realization comes by grace, not by effort? In order to remove the insidious idea that the ego self can continue to exist and attain something called realization, whereas all it can do is to immolate itself and be replaced by the realized state of the Spirit, which is ever-present grace. The mind makes efforts to remove obstructions. It is hard for it to understand that it is itself the final obstruction. The very desire for realization has to be carefully watched and can become an impediment, for it implies someone to achieve something. At the end, all that the mind is called to do is to keep still and allow the grace to flow unimpeded. But that is the hardest thing of all to do. Till in the end, all battles fought, all earthly loves abjured, dawn in the east, there is no other way but to be still in stillness than to find the giants all were windmills, all the strife, self-made, unreal. Even he that strove, a fancied being, and when that good knight woke from delirium, and with a loud cry rendered his soul to God. On the devotional path, this danger of supposing that it is the ego who strives and attains, this warning against desires, even the desire to get realization, is expressed in the attitude that true service of God must be for love alone, with no thought of reward. He who asks for reward is a merchant, not a lover. The impossibility of achieving when there is no one to achieve explains why a guru will never answer the question, when shall I attain realization? It implies the false presumption, there is individual me, when will it cease to exist? Whereas the guru realizes the ultimate truth that there is no being of the unreal and no not being of the real. Not that the unreal ego will cease to be at such and such a point in time, but that it is not now, never has been, and never could be. Therefore, the attitude of mind which questions when one can attain realization or whether it is one's destiny to be realized in this lifetime is an obstruction sufficient to prevent realization, being an assertion of the temporary existence of the unreal. Similarly, if you assert that you cannot attain realization in this lifetime, you are thereby preventing yourself from doing so by postulating the existence of a you who cannot attain. For the disciple, effort is necessary, but it is also necessary to remember that effort can never attain the final goal, since he who makes the effort must dissolve, leaving only the Spirit. The Spirit, which is the true self, replaces the illusory ego self when the latter has removed the obstructions, and that is grace. The Spirit flows into the vacuum which remains when the ego self dissolves. Doing so is the choice which the spirit makes. It is for the aspirant to create the vacuum by removing the obstructions.
Dennis, it's pronounced aspirant.
Aspirant?
Mm-hmm.
What did I say?
Aspirant.
Oh.
That spells it all out of what to do. Yeah. Easier said than done. But then I'm just, by saying that, I put up a barrier, right?
That's right.
I don't remember. Who is that written by? The article.
Pardon?
Arthur Osborne wrote that article.
Yeah.
That was Arthur Osborne, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's the best.